A non-rhetorical question as a starting point today. Is anybody listening to anybody about what's really going on in this economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the first day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So 7 weeks, right? That's where we are in this quarantine, give or take. April's done, mercifully. The week is done, also mercifully. So what the heck happened the past 5 days, and what do you suppose it all meant? Kate Davidson's of the Wall Street Journal. Gina Smilek is with the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me start with you and Fed Chair Jay Powell, the press conference via Zoom, I guess it was. I don't even know, that he gave on Wednesday. You were in it. Was it Zoom? What was it? Zoom, YouTube? What did they do?
It was – I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that, but it was dialed in over a web.
You had a secret login? There you go. All right. Fair enough.
We had a lot.
Fair enough. You were on the call, on the meeting. You got the first question, and you, in essence, said – what about Congress and what role does Congress have to play, right? First of all, am I remembering your question right? And then tell us what he said, because that I think is instrumental here.
Right. Yeah, you are remembering my question correctly. And
phew,
he had a lot to say about it. He kind of continued to say something about it for the remainder of the press conference. So he basically said that, you know, I think his major message at this entire press conference was things could get bad. If things get really bad, Congress is going to need to step it up, I think was essentially the message. You know, he said many times, policymakers have a really crucial role to play in making sure that this doesn't turn into a real disaster. And the Fed is going to do what it can, and it is going to push its powers to their limit, but they have a limit. And so Congress is going to need to step in and make sure that people don't go into sort of these mass bankruptcies or mass insolvencies. And so I think that was his real message out of this press conference.
Yeah, he said it a bunch of times, and by policymakers here, he means, Kate, fiscal policymakers. But let me ask you this. We got yesterday, I guess it was, right? The days do kind of run together. News of another 3.8 million first-time claims for unemployment. 30 million in all have filed for unemployment benefits in like the last 6 weeks. It is staggering. And yet Congress can't quite seem to understand, in my view, the urgency here.
Well, Kai, I would counter that a little bit
and say that they have.
I mean, since things really got wild, over the past 7 weeks, Congress has authorized $3.5 trillion in new spending to respond to this. And you know, as a share of GDP, that's about what it spent over 5 years during the last crisis. So I actually have talked to some economists who were former Obama administration officials, for example, who said, they seem to have learned the lesson from the last crisis, which is you should go big early, as soon as you can. So they've responded with quite a bit. I guess what I would say is a little, confusing or concerning for some people is that there's this suggestion out there that we've maybe done enough, or maybe we need to pause and assess where things are. And it's not really clear that we need another big package or what it should include, which is, I think, what you're referring to. And that is concerning, I think.
Yeah. And look, to be fair, they can't even figure out how to meet safely. So we have to give them props for trying, I suppose. Gina, I want to circle back to Powell one more time and something he said. And he said it many times, but never as emphatically. One of the reasons he gives in these press conferences for wanting to sustain, or he did before it all fell off the table, he would say, we need to keep this expansion going because only now, 9 and 10 years into this recovery, are low income people feeling the benefits, are feeling the gains in wages and jobs. And he actually said this time, when you look at what's happening to low and moderate income people in this economy right now, it's heartbreaking. And I don't want to put too much, too many feels, I guess, in Powell's mouth. But that's an amazing thing for a central banker to say.
Yeah, no, I think Jay Powell is having all the feels this week. I think it's a reasonable thing to put in his mouth. I think it's important to step back and remember that Jay Powell's legacy has been the job market. You know, Janet Yellen before him really was patient with interest rates, kept them low. And what we saw under her tenure and under Jay Powell's tenure is unemployment that touched its lowest level in half a century. And for a lot of minority worker groups, actually hit record lows. And I think that that was a real accomplishment that they took a lot of pride in. They felt like they had done the right thing by the economy and that that was a massive sort of social good that was lifting a lot of boats. And now that's all in peril. And I think we heard Powell really sort of worry out loud over that and worry sort of with the rest of the country about what that's going to look like coming out of this crisis.
Yeah. Let me break the fourth wall here for a minute, Kate, and confess to listeners of this program that we send our Friday wrappers a general list of things that I'm curious about along about Friday morning sometime. And then we get on the radio and we talk about them. I'm going to take you sideways a little bit right now, and I'm going to ask you about the trend, the moving now toward reopening parts of this economy. And this is a little bit to get back to the feels of Jay Powell. I wonder maybe if one of the reasons that reopening is proving so hard, politics aside, right, but businesses are having a tough time, workers are having a tough time, people are scared. We haven't really acknowledged, we haven't grieved what we lost in the before times. Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah. Right. I mean, there seems to be this, right. I don't know, this idea or this feeling that things are just going to go back to normal. Yeah. And I mean, I know people are acknowledging that that's not really going to happen, but, a lot of the sort of talk around this, the rhetoric, from administration officials had been, we're going to bounce back. Things are going to be just as strong, if not stronger. And, you know, I think that it's maybe starting to sink in for people. And as we're seeing some states start to reopen, how difficult that is, this realization that, this is going to be a lot harder. And for the economy, this could last a lot longer than people realize. Yeah. It's not just a matter of, well, people are out of work, but once the shutdowns end, everyone will go back to work and businesses will be there. And clearly, that's not going to be the case.
Kate Davidson is at the Wall Street Journal. Gino Smilek is at the New York Times. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
Have a nice weekend. Yeah, do something nice for yourself because it's getting old. There is a saying among Wall Street veterans, sell in May and go away. We are one day into the new month, and sell traders did. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Doesn't get much tougher for retailers than it is right now in this economy. Nobody's buying much. Stores aren't open, just not good, right? Pile today's reality on top of what had already been a tough stretch for some of them, and you get news reports like this. J. Crew is expected to file for bankruptcy protection this week. Neiman Marcus missed some debt payments not too long ago. It's said to be on the brink as well. True Religion, which I learned today does premium jeans, filed Chapter 11 last month. So we're in a place where a bunch of retailers might be looking for bankruptcy protection at roughly the same time, which, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, isn't good for them, and it's not good for the economy.
For years now, we've seen one retail bankruptcy after another. Sears, Forever 21, Toys R Us, and analysts have compiled a sort of bankruptcy watch list, too. J.Crew is on it. It's got a lot of debt. Its sales have been falling, and it was starting to turn things around with a planned spinoff of its brand Madewell, but that fell through in March. And now?
We're facing a year of pretty severe disruption and a 2021 of most likely only partial recovery in consumer spending.
Raya Sokolianska is a senior analyst at Moody's. Even if J.Crew and other retailers might have filed for bankruptcy eventually, things will be much worse for everyone if these companies are all forced into it at the same time. Remember, when companies file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, they're trying to stay alive.
When a company goes bankrupt, it does not necessarily mean they go out of business.
Craig Rowley is a senior partner at Korn Ferry Consulting.
Companies choose to go bankrupt sometimes because it allows them to wipe out the debt or renegotiate the debt and close stores that are not profitable.
But these companies need banks to lend them money so they can fund their operations during the bankruptcy process. And Raleigh says that's going to be hard to come by right now.
It will be harder for companies to get financing, and it'll most likely be more expensive. And the reason for that is just the uncertainty of the current environment.
Also, when retailers file for bankruptcy, they close stores and hold liquidation sales to drum up some cash. Vishal Garr at Cornell says that's tough to do right now.
At this time, when people cannot get out of home, brick and mortar shopping is down, that inventory is going to sit in those stores. I cannot convert it into cash.
So retailers that are pushed into a bankruptcy filing at this moment are more likely to go out of business entirely. And we know what that means for the economy. More people out of a job and more clothing and shoe suppliers with nowhere to sell their products. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
We are going to go back to work. Eventually. It's going to look a lot different. More space between people, more dividers, fewer common work areas. But it's not just workspaces that are going to have to be redesigned. From our Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Think about the typical open office. Those long tables crammed with workers practically on top of each other. Simply adding some plexiglass and masks is not going to cut it. Many workplaces will need to find ways to cut back on the number of workers in one place at one time.
I do think the one-size-fits-all 9-to-5 is probably gone.
Callie Williams-Yost is a business consultant specializing in flexible work. She says companies could stagger starting times or have fewer, longer shifts on alternate days.
So you split people up. A teams come in on certain days and B teams come on in certain days, and never do they overlap.
The sudden shift to remote work has already forced companies to become more flexible. So blowing up the schedule is just the natural next step, says Alex Pang, author of the book Shorter, Work Better, Smarter, and Less.
You know, this opens up a recognition that there are changes in the way that we work that maybe are closer to hand, are more accessible than we thought before.
Like working fewer hours altogether. Pang says a four-day work week with employees taking different days of the week off could help solve the short-term issue of staggering work shifts. And research has found it can have benefits for business, too.
You can actually be just as productive or more productive. People are happier. Work-life balance is better, and recruitment and retention go way up.
Philadelphia software company WildBit has been working a four-day week for years. Here's CEO Natalie Nagel.
So the hypothesis was that we are spending a lot of our days on things that aren't really valuable. Just meetings, procrastination, it's inefficiencies, things like that.
Shorter work weeks and flexible schedules could become less of a perk and more of a necessity. With many schools closed, uncertainty about childcare, and many companies still figuring out how to retrofit their physical workspaces. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Think of the businesses you can't fathom life without.
I can name a couple, I think. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's on a Friday because of this. The Dow Industrial's off 622, 2.5%, closed at 23,723. The NASDAQ down 284 points. That is 3.2%. 86.04. The S&P 500 fell 81 points, 2.8%, 28.30 there. For the week gone by, the Dow off 0.2%, the NASDAQ down 0.3%, the S&P 500 gave up 0.1%. Pretty much a wash for the week, really, but April was oh so good to investors. Elon Musk tweeted this morning, and this is a quote, okay? The guy runs Tesla. Here's the quote. Tesla stock price is too high, IMO. The market obliged. Shares in the carmaker down 10.3% today. I don't even know. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. $1,200 lands in your bank account or the check shows up in your mailbox. What do you do with it? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent today checking to see how people are spending those relief payments.
People are using the money to pay for obvious things, rent or mortgage, food, increasingly takeout. Stuart Sopp is CEO of the fintech firm Current, a bank that's been tracking how people are spending their relief payments. He noticed something else they were using the money for.
Every time we've seen a wave of those stimulus checks hitting, we've seen people paying their friends back, friends and family clearly being the safety net for many, many people here.
That was especially true of the earliest direct deposits. Now, with other types of stimulus coming through the pipeline, Sopp says more people are catching up on other expenses.
We see a round of bill pay, so people paying their bills and also auto loans or auto leases being paid almost immediately.
That's what Lauren Howie in Cleveland did. She received the full $1,200.
I made a list of things I needed to take care of. So medical bills and the last chunk of my car loan.
She's still working, so the money was a windfall for her.
I did feel a little bad about not putting it into the economy because we need it so badly. But yeah, those bills weren't going anywhere.
Lots of people who shared their stories with me today said they donated their checks to charity. Many others, like Mike Foster in Marietta, Georgia, were torn.
My first instinct was to donate it.
He's relatively new in his sales job at a software company and is already taking a 20% pay cut due to COVID-19.
My job is great right now, but let's say a month from now I lose it. That $1,200 is 4 months worth of groceries.
So for now, Foster is keeping the money in his savings account, just in case. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There are rescue packages right and left in this economy. Small businesses, individuals, as Kimberly was just saying. The Fed said yesterday it's thinking about a program for nonprofits, which is a totally new thing for the central bank. One slice, though notably absent, consumer debt relief, although there is a big exception to that. Most student loans, all direct federal loans, those held by the government, that is, rather than banks, are on pause till the end of September. That means no payments and, importantly, no interest accruing either, which is a huge help to a lot of people with student debt, but not all of them, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
When Krista Pekacek first heard that she wouldn't have to pay her student loans for 6 months and that no interest would accrue,
it was a huge relief for me because there was no way I was going to make those loan payments if that hadn't happened.
She's a baker, and she still has about $30,000 in loans from when she got her associate's degree at the Culinary Institute Le Cordon Bleu in Seattle. She pays about $400 a month, which is a lot for her, especially since she got laid off about a month ago. It's been tough.
I got some help from some friends. A lot of people on Twitter were nice enough to send some money my way. If it weren't for that, I wouldn't have been able to pay for rent this month.
Much less her student loans. Once she starts getting unemployment checks, she's planning to use the money that would have gone to her loans to build up some savings. That is exactly what Betsy Mayotte recommends. She's president of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors.
If you don't have any other debt, I would build up the emergency fund a little more. We don't know how long the economic impact is going to be for this.
Or, she says, if you do have other debt, especially with high interest like credit cards, you might want to pay that down instead. But not everyone who has student loans is getting a break right now. Not all loans qualify. Chloe Seymour has some that do and some that don't. She's 26, lives in Detroit, and she is getting a break on her federal loan payments, which are about $160 a month, but not on her private loans, which run her over $300 a month.
So it's a pretty large chunk of money that I have to worry about.
It feels like an especially big chunk now because she's also worried about the possibility of losing her job at a small nonprofit.
If tomorrow we decide that it's looking like we have to shutter the business, then that $300-ish that I pay every month would be groceries and part of rent for me. So yeah, it's definitely a large part of my budget.
So though she is grateful her federal loan is on pause,
I feel as though that's a really big missed opportunity is helping people with private loans.
Student loan advisor Betsy Mayotte agrees. But, she says, even if your loans don't qualify for this automatic pause, you may still have options if you're having trouble paying.
I do know that many lenders are trying to be as flexible as possible during this sort of weird time that we're in. So absolutely make the call rather than just going radio silent and letting the loan negatively affect your credit.
Chloe Seymour did make the call, but
there has been no budging.
And she doesn't think there will be, not unless the government steps in. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Sam put together a student loan relief FAQ you might want to have a look at should you be paying on one of those loans. It's at marketplace.org. You've got an issue with something you've bought, you pick up the phone, you call customer service, and you get it most of the time taken care of. No, it's not usually a great experience, but compared to customer service right now, those were halcyon days. Calls today to file for unemployment or to get an airline refund or hunt down a lost package, you're talking hours, if not days, to get through to a human being. Bad as it is for you, though, spare a thought, would you? For the person on the other end of the phone just trying to do their job in this strange new world. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Customer service lines right now are a bit of a maze. You dial up, you get a familiar greeting.
Welcome to Chase.
You follow a zillion prompts.
For credit card, loan, or line information and payments, press 1.
And then you get the bad news.
Due to COVID-19, many of our call centers are closed.
Followed by that lovely hold music. On the other end of that music is a customer service rep with a line of callers that never lets up.
We powered through it.
Daphne Cervantes works at Freshly, a meal subscription service. Most of the calls she gets are about shipping delays, but every once in a while, someone has a question that isn't in her handbook.
One time this customer called in because they wanted a picture of the mask.
As in the masks employees wear when they prep the food. Cervantes couldn't get a photo because she's now working out of her home in Phoenix. And she says the customer was nice about it. Cervantes says people have been pretty friendly in general. Chatty, even.
They're not afraid to go into detail.
But getting through calls quickly is more important now that companies are dealing with a surge. At Expedia, call volume is 7 times higher than usual. Vrbo, a vacation rental site, has hired an extra 250 customer service reps. And people have been tweeting about being on hold with banks for hours. Not a good look. Christy Pambianchi oversees crisis response protocols at Verizon, which has employees here, plus in Europe and Asia.
Right now, every country is responding differently to coronavirus. And then within the United States, every state is responding differently.
There's a lot to coordinate, like equipment and internet security, because calls can involve credit cards and social security numbers that need to be protected. And dealing with customers from home also requires some flexibility.
So we've told our employees it's okay if, you know, a customer hears their pet or hears something going on in the background.
Many companies are discouraging customers from calling at all. Most have online chat boxes and some let you request a call back so you don't have to sit on hold. But if none of that works, customers often turn to Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter to vent. John DeJulius owns the DeJulius Group, which does customer service consulting for brands like Marriott, Nordstrom, and Starbucks. He says if customers are frustrated enough to rant on social media, brands are more likely to lose their business.
And if you think of the businesses you can't fathom life without, it's typically because of a human relationship, an emotional connection made.
DeJulius says in a crisis, the quality of customer service can have a lasting impact, and refunds or cancellation policies may not be enough to keep people happy. Customers want a real person when they call, and not so much of this. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that the operative phrase in the commodity markets during this crisis has been glut. We've got a glut of oil. We told you about that. Packing plants being shut down means we've got a glut of hogs and cattle. Also, apparently, we have a glut of mint. The Kentucky Derby was supposed to have been tomorrow. It has been slid until September. We will see about that. But in the meanwhile, That is a whole lot of mint juleps that are not going to be drunk tomorrow. And mint, as we know, is perishable. 2 tons of mint is what we're talking about. The farmer who has supplied the Derby with its mint for 40 years told the Washington Post he's going to try to grow fresh stuff for that race in September. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials down 622 today, 2.5%. The NASDAQ down 284. That is 3.2%. The S&P 500 lost 81 points. That is 2.8%. Tough start to May in the markets. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend, a safe one, please. Take care of yourselves. As I said to Gina and Kate, do something nice for yourself. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.